Thanks very much for joining us on the Unknown Strength podcast. This is episode 7 and extra special episode today. We're coming at you live from Huntington Beach, California. I'm here at the Kilo Strength Society headquarters with a very special guest, Mr. Stefan Cazol. Now, Stefan and I first met a couple of years ago in Rhode Island, where I was doing the Poliquin Group PICP Level 4 certification, and Stefan was Director of Strength and Conditioning at Poliquin Group. Since then, Stefan has moved on and created his own amazing strength and conditioning facility here in Huntington, and I'll let Stefan get into a little bit more about that in a minute. But Stefan, how are you doing? And thanks for joining us.
Very good, McGregor. I'm happy to be here with you.
Excellent, excellent. And as I said, this is such an amazing facility. Thank you so much for hosting me for the last couple of days.
Thank you.
It's been amazing. So why don't we get into the thick of things and you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started in the strength and conditioning field.
Yeah, so my background is I grew up in a small town in Quebec, Canada. So, you know, I was a very active kid into sports and everything. Me and my parents, we moved to Western Africa in Burkina Faso when I was 8 and 9 years old. And, you know, at that point, food was kind of scarce. And when we got back to Canada in 1986, and with lack of knowledge on nutrition, my parents just like bought whatever I wanted as far as food goes. So from the age of 9 and 11, I kind of blew up a little bit and got a little bit fatter. But at the same time, I was involved in judo, and I was always competing with guys a little bit older than me because of my body weight. And like around 11 years of age, I started becoming a little bit self-conscious of that, and that's where like I started being intrigued by bodybuilding, you know, and like everybody was Arnold, and it was like Sylvester Stallone, Jean-Claude Van Damme at the time on TV, and I kind of wanted to look like them. So I told my dad for Christmas that I wanted the weights to start training. And my dad gets so excited because he used to train when he was a teenager. So the next day I get back from school and I had that York cement barbell weight kit and a York bench and some little dumbbells. And he's like, we're going to wake up in the morning before school. We're going to train together. So I trained with my dad, but his knowledge was not very, like, for instance, barbell bent over row, he would pull the barbell to his chest. So because the barbell touched his chest, he thought he was working his pectorals.
Right.
So it just tells you the level of knowledge. But, and then, like, it just started there. I mean, I don't know, I was, like, training every day and really enjoyed it. And then I got involved in American football, and my training started to shift a little bit more for athletic purposes. And when I was 14 years of age, I saw a show on a Saturday morning on an American channel, and they showed the Tampa Bay Buccaneers strength and conditioning staff in their new facility. And I remember being so impressed by the big gym and the coaches and the football players training there that I was like, wow, that's what I want to do when I grow up. So from that day on, I started reading on training, writing programs for my friend, for myself. And when I went to university, from the get-go, I knew that I wanted to be a strength and conditioning coach, and I knew that I wanted to work with NFL players. But being in Canada, you don't really have access to this. You know, you have the CFL, but it's a very on a lower scale. The income of those players is not that significant.
So compared to the NFL.
Compared to the NFL, right? So when I went to university, the last 2 years you could choose if you wanted to go phys ed, health, or sports science. I decided to go sports science to get all the knowledge that I could on that aspect. And once I graduated, and well, in fact, I was still at university, but I started training in a commercial gym facility. So I was training Gen Pop, but as I graduated, then I wanted to shift my focus more to performance. But with time working in that high-end facility in Montreal called the Sanctuaire, where it was like very high-end gen pop, I made a name for myself and I started attracting amateur athletes, so basketball players, rowers, marathon runners, triathletes, stuff like that, actors, to get ready for photo, for movies and photo shoots and stuff like that. And, you know, I started doing more continuing education, and eventually that was in 1998. Now flash forward to 2005, I had the opportunity to move to the United States to work in a high performance center in St. Louis, mm-hmm. where it, the ownership there was a chiropractor and I was the head of training, and we had professional athletes. It was hockey at first, but we finally got football, which was now finally my dream, and then we had baseball. And did this from 2005 to 2012. Then I was approached to work at Pollockin Group, and because, you know, I've always wanted to be part of Pollockin Group, because in my earlier days I took the job and I spent 4 years there as the strength and conditioning head of strength conditioning. And, you know, I taught some classes like yours, for instance, and got some experience. And then in 2016, I resigned and started Kilo Strength Society.
Fantastic. And none of our listeners can see some of these pictures you've got on the wall in here. In the facility, I mean, I see baseball players, I see NFL football players, I see NHL hockey players, triathletes, all kinds of athletes pictured, signed pictures up on the wall here. Can you just share with us who some of these guys are?
Yeah, so the athlete I trained the longest, it was basically his entire career, was Steven Jackson, who was... he's retired now, but he was a star, like NFL running back. Mm-hmm. Matt Holliday in baseball, Chris Carpenter in baseball, Adam Wainwright, Dennis Wyman in hockey, Drew Bennett, Bobby Keppel, a bunch. Like, so the majority was football, hockey, and baseball, but I also trained athletes in many different sports.
Many different sports.
Wrestling, judo, MMA, rugby. Soccer, trained Heather Mitz for a little bit. She was on the USA soccer team for a while. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, it's just a wide range of sports.
Yeah, a lot of high-profile athletes in there as well.
That's
incredible. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about when you were coming up the ranks as a young strength and conditioning coach, who were some of your biggest influences in the industry?
Yeah, so the one who kind of really changed in my outtake on training was Charles Pollockin. When I first read an article he wrote in 1997 in Muscle Media 2000, mm-hmm. That really kind of changed my perspective, because it looked so much more scientific and less generic bodybuilding magazine type stuff, with the tempo and the rest period and seconds and all that kind of stuff, the double station superset. So it really piqued my interest. And then I approached a local bodybuilder out of Montreal who was a trainer, and I hired him to make my write my programs in 98, and he used the same approach. So
right.
So he kind of became my mentor, because every month I would go back to him and he would explain to me the new program and show me exercises, and he really helped me out improving my skills. So his name was Larry Vinette. So he's a well-known bodybuilding prep coach right now.
Yep. I've seen his name around a lot.
Yeah, he's pretty big. He's pretty popular. He's an IFBB pro as well. He was more like of a true live mentor. Yep. But as far as pioneers, there was Charles Pollockin. Obviously, Al Vermeil was a big influence.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, who was Al Vermeil for the listeners?
Yeah, so Al Vermeil, he's actually one of the first professional strength coach. He's the first guy who actually got paid to strength train people. So I think we have to go all the way back to the late 70s, and it was the Oakland Raiders
right.
who hired him. His His brother was actually an NFL coach for the Philadelphia Eagles and St. Louis Rams and Kansas City Chiefs. But, yeah, so he was a sports strength coach. So he trained at the Chicago Bulls during Michael Jordan's A-days and all these things. So he's been around forever. He's still there. He does courses and conferences all over the place. So a pioneer in the industry. So I learned from him. And there was Ian King from Australia, too. Charlie Francis, Eric Serrano, John Berardi. So they were all like people that influenced early on my training and or nutrition knowledge.
That's excellent. And, you know, what are some of the craziest and most ridiculous trends and fads and gimmicks you've seen in this industry in your career?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question because, I mean, the thing about the fitness industry is it rotates all the time.
Right.
Like trends. So, like, I'm 39 now and I started so early that I feel that I've lived enough to kind of see old stuff cycling back in right now, which I find very, very funny. Like, for the latest example is like the whole keto thing.
Yep.
I mean, in my opinion, like, that was kind of big in the late 90s, early 2000, but it disappeared for a reason. It's not efficient. Especially for athletic training, and now like now they bring exogenous ketones, but the problem with that is it's been shown to really, and it's not really talked about, but it's been shown to really wreck the whole gut flora.
Really?
So now as you're thinking you're improving your ketogenic performance, but so what if you're wrecking your gut health, which will in turn affect your immune response, which will in turn affect your performance. So I just don't think it's another fad. That's going to disappear like everything else. So it's the same thing with training. So you have like that's it's an easy answer, but you know, the whole functional training crave.
Yep.
You know, that was just, and it always comes back, but under different terms, different models.
So break down what functional actually means then.
Well, so, you know, like the functional training trend is, so let's say you're a mixed martial artist, you're a striker, so then you would take either like a weight that you wrap around your wrist or a pulley and you start striking, right? So you're mimicking your punch, but with a loaded weight.
With resistance.
So they make it more, they think it's more functional because you're doing the movement pattern of your sport, unlike, let's say, a barbell bench press, which has nothing to do with striking because you're not striking with two hands holding a barbell. So that's the reasoning.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is then you have neurophysiology that's not proper with loaded functional sport specific movement, because the velocity of a punch is very fast. So if you add a weight that slows down the neural recruitment that recruits the actual motor units to, you need to go super fast. So you're basically teaching your nervous system to become slower. So there's nothing functional about it,
and you're also messing up the deceleration aspect of the movement as well when you add resistance to a punch.
You're very true.
Yeah, so it's a totally different motor skill. And it's funny, I was talking about this with Yas Parr recently. You know, it just has no place in training for strikers whatsoever. And the guys that you see doing it often, they're doing it, you know, they're doing these, they're having great success in their sport in spite of these stupid practices. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, so sometimes you can measure success better with taking somebody with limited athletic and fighting skills and really improving his athleticism for performance fighting than having like a freak, like genetically gifted, doing random workouts and then using him as an example of what's proper strength and conditioning training.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's very misleading.
Indeed. And just back to the functional thing.
Yeah.
What exactly should functional, like you know, inverted commas, functional training look like for a mixed martial artist, for example? What even does functional mean? I mean, do you want to delve in as deep as, you know, Zatskiorski's concept of dynamic correspondence, or, you know, how far do you want to go with it?
As much as I like Zatskiorski, and he's my favorite training author, I think that it's a little too... his examples are a little too extreme. Like, right. it's a little too sport specific for my taste. Yep. But that being said, I respect him immensely to what he brought to the game. But here's how I look at it, and I'm going to quote a colleague of mine, Ryan Fainley, because I love the way he describes it. When it comes to athletic training, weight training is basically GPP. Mm-hmm. For your sports.
Right.
It's anything, general preparation.
Anything with a barbell.
Doesn't matter. Weight training, mm-hmm. It's general preparation for your sport.
Yep.
There's nothing that's ever going to be immensely specific about what you're doing in the weight room for your sport.
Right.
But you're using the weight room to build a foundational base of strength and power that... Once you build that, you'll go and transfer in the practice of your sport.
Indeed.
Okay? But you cannot use the weight room or weight training exercises to transfer right there in the weight room into an athletic action of your given sport.
Right. Mimicking that's, movements. And
yeah, that's
like
just
that.
Not how it works. So, but at the same time, if I'm doing a back squat... And my athlete got from a 100 kilo back squat to a 150 kilo back squat over 18 months of training. Now I know that my athlete's is stronger. Mm-hmm. So assuming that throughout that period of time, he went and practiced his sport and got accustomed to that new level of strength and was able to transfer it into his task. Now I know that by nature is fighting power, strength will be much higher. Now, that being said, at one point in time, you reach a point where there's such a thing sometimes, depending on the sport, as enough strength or too much strength, which makes it, at that point, you kind of need to get your athletes to be a little bit more powerful, which is all about rate of force development, so moving the force velocity curve to the left. So at that point, you use techniques like dynamic effort, plyometrics, kinetic, to transfer that newfound strength into more powerful or faster contraction that then, again, by practicing your sport, you'll be able to transfer that into a faster, harder punch.
Yep.
But the weight training is never specific on a functional component.
Indeed.
Per se.
Yep. And we see lots of examples of that, of, you know, strength coaches, again in inverted commas, you know, trying to mimic sports movements on the weight room floor, using resistance and things like that. But back to what you were saying, you know, about transferring the strength into rate of force development and power. One thing Joel Jameson says in a lot of his work is the higher levels of the sport that you get to, the one thing that most sports have in common is that the game moves so much faster. Like, the speed of the action is so much faster. So the higher the level of your sport you want to get to, or you are already at, the greater the need for transferring your strength levels into, you know, explosive, powerful, you know, movements and contractions. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally agree. But it's a balanced thing. So the thing with, so you might have an athlete that, I'll take an American football analogy just because it's a sport I know the most.
Sure.
But there's this wide receiver. He weighs about, I think he weighs like 80 kilos.
Right.
Okay. And he's super fast.
Right.
But his strength level is quite poor.
Right.
But in his nervous system, he's able to tap in a high amount of fast twitch fibers. So he's exerting a lot of forces and speed, even though his your strength base is not that high.
Okay.
But for him, if I wanted him to become even faster, now my focus would not be on fast training methods. It would be on getting him stronger,
yeah,
because that's his biggest lack. And if he has a stronger base, then once you build that up, then you re-transfer that stronger base again into speed, and then he can be faster. But on the flip side, if you have a guy who squats 200 kilos but is slow, then you have to focus on training on speed methods. So it really is a balanced question too.
Right. Would you say that same principle applies to fighters in the combat sports? Say, for example, you've got like the equivalent of your 80 kilo wide receiver is, you know, say a 65, 70 kilo fighter who doesn't have a huge amount of strength, but is actually quite fast and moves quite well in the cage or in the ring. Would you say that the need there is to build levels of strength in that fighter before you're able to get any more speed and power out of him?
Yeah, I think it's the exact same thing. And one thing I always tell students is the reason why I liked training so many different athletes in my career, not just specify on one, is in my state of mind and my point of view is I never train an MMA fighter, I never train a football player, I train an athlete.
Right.
So if I can get a human being to be a better athlete, then it's up to them in their sport to transfer that.
Right.
Because I can never make someone a better football player, a better rugby player, a better fighter. I can only make him a better athlete. That's the task of a strength and conditioning coach. So it's their job to transfer that. Now, as a strength coach, though, you need to be able to provide the tool to get them to be a better athlete. And to become a better athlete, the simplest thing to improve athleticism is to work on the biggest weakness.
Right.
So if it's strength, you work on that. If it's hypertrophy, because sometimes it can be hypertrophy, you work on that.
Like a small wide receiver, for example, you'd want them to get a bit bigger.
Exactly, because so if you have bigger muscle fibers, you have more potential for force development,
right,
and to create tension. So you need to be fast. You also need like low.
Yep, yep.
So
you need resistance.
Yeah, they both come hand in hand. But to me, it's always the same thing. It's like the sport up to a certain point, it doesn't really matter in the sense that it always comes back to train what's the weakest link.
Right.
Because if you're an MMA fighter, NFL wide receiver, or hockey player, if when they evaluate you, your spinal erectors are super weak, well, it doesn't matter which one of the three sports you're performing, you're not going to perform to your best.
That's right. Okay. Yep. So, I mean, true functionality is first building that foundation of strength from which, you know, you can perform, you know, your skills in the sport, you know, more effectively, or, you know, you can transfer that foundation of strength into high levels of rate of force development and things like that.
Yeah, so that's why, in a way, like, you know, when you have your off season, like the general preparation phase, like the earlier phase of training, up to a certain point, it's very similar between different sports,
mm-hmm,
because you're training multiple movement patterns and weaknesses and on, so it's only once you hit the specific preparation phase that now the demands of the sport, so the predictor lifts of the sport, becomes the main focus.
Yep, yep.
So that's where you fine-tune your athlete development to the sport he's practicing, but at the base, it's very similar for everybody.
Yeah. And just on that, with predictor lifts, what would you suggest would be some of the predictor lifts for mixed martial arts?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on the style, but as a general rule of thumb, as far as lower body goes, there's two that I really like: the front squat,
mm-hmm,
and the deadlift.
And the deadlift.
The reason why I like the deadlift is hip extensor strength can be a very dominant factor in a fighter's arsenal. But the reason why I also like the front squat is It's a good indication of athletic skills, dynamic flexibility, but also all that, so your lower body, but all that combined with upper back strength and stability,
of course.
Because you have to be able to stabilize the barbell in front of your body in the front rack position, which requires a lot of triceps, lats, wrist flexibility, a lot of mid-back stabilization properties. So I think it has a good carryover to mixed martial arts, because that's a very important area. And then as far as upper body goes, if we're looking at flexors, chin up is obviously an obvious one.
Any particular grip angle for the chin up?
I mean, most of the normative data is on the supinated grip, because it's been the one the most tested. But you can, I would say that if you want to be more specific with your own group of people, I would probably go neutral. But there's just more normative data on the supinated grip. And then so we're looking at pressing or extensor exercises for upper body. The incline press tends to be kind of the good general pressing exercise as far as predictor lift.
Right, it seems to be the gold standard.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just for the listeners, could you just explain a little bit about what a predictor lift actually does, why it's called that?
Yeah, so, okay, so a predictor lift, so let's say that you have your athletes and whatever mixed martial arts he performs in, you determine as a strength coach that his upper body predictor lift is incline press and his lower body predictor lift is front squat. Okay, so now, it doesn't, predictor lift doesn't necessarily mean, especially not in a sport with as much variables as mixed martial arts, that by improving his front squat and or incline press, that it absolutely means you're going to improve his win-loss ratio or performance, but it still gives you an indication as a strength coach. It gives you a specific exercise to gauge the progress on, to give you an idea of how good your athletes progress through a specific preparation phase. So if you have a 12, 16, or 24-week specific preparation phase before a fighting season, and you focus on bringing up that incline press through that period of time, and you went from an 80-kilo incline to a 105-kilo incline, well, that gives you a measurable outcome on a lift that represents a good general extensor strength perspective of what's going on with your athletes, but it gives you an idea of, okay, he's gained 15 kilo on his incline press, that's a good off-season. That's a good program. If on the flip side, he's only gained 2 kilos, then you as a strength coach, you need to reassess the training program. There's something wrong that happened because the progress wasn't there. So that's why I like predictor lift. It's just a tool for the strength coach.
Excellent. That's great. And so is there any more, back to the fads and gimmicks, Is there anything else that you've seen, maybe specifically for fighters?
I think I've seen this with fighters a lot, but I don't even know what's the name of it. But that mask there that they...
The altitude training mask?
Yeah. that to me is a funny one. I don't think that there's much carryover. I don't think the data is very significant on it. Just do conditioning training.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's a very funny one.
Yeah, it just makes it more difficult to breathe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't actually simulate altitude training at all.
Not really.
Yeah.
No, nor does it, I don't know, to me, it doesn't simulate anything.
It's funny, this is another thing that Yas and I were talking about the other day. All right, so... What about on the positive side, what are some of the biggest breakthroughs you've seen in terms of science and practice in strength and conditioning these days? And who have you seen that's doing that stuff really well?
I mean, honestly, I think that I don't know if it's a breakthrough in terms of it just happened, but it's still pretty recent in the strength conditioning world, but I think is... the importance now that strength and conditioning coaches have and exercise physiologists have of how well the central nervous system can affect training outcome.
Right.
And I think that in the past, because in exercise physiology, a lot of the professors from who kind of grew up in the 70s had more of a metabolic mentality to things.
Right.
So they always looked at training through a metabolic like scope of view. I think they missed on the importance of CNS recovery for sports performance. And I think that that's been a little bit more talked about in the last 15 years. There's more research on it. So the thing is, if you can optimize the training of your athlete, and especially MMA, by having longer rest period, higher quality reps. So what I mean by that is a lot of MMA training sometimes that you see, it's still old school. It's still very metabolically driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might do like 15, 20 reps with like 30 seconds rest in between sets. But the problem with that is, yes, you're training your metabolic, the metabolic component of your body, but that's what you do when you practice your sport.
Mm-hmm.
So you should use weight training to train the central nervous system to be more efficient at recruiting high threshold motor units so that you as an athlete, you become more powerful. But the only way you can do that is by giving enough rest to your central nervous system to recuperate, to be able to go and tap into these high threshold motor units again in the next, the second, third, fourth, fifth set. And you also need sets. You cannot develop power or central nervous efficiency with only one, two, or three sets.
Mm.
There comes a point in time where you need four, five, six sets because it's about law of repetition. So you need to expose a CNS to repetitive, high-quality repetitions. And I would also add to this that the concentric contraction should always be as fast as you can.
Right.
The intent should be as fast as you can. So if you're training at 90% of your 1RM, the bar speed might not be that fast, but you want the intent to be as fast as possible. And just that will help you target higher threshold more units.
Yeah.
So because training, and especially in MMA, you have limited time for weight training, you really want to make sure that every rep you do is of the highest quality.
Right.
To optimize central nervous system output. So that, to me, I think is a big breakthrough. And it's not a sexy one, but it's a very important one. And that's for sure one that was not really touted like in the 70s and even early 80s.
Yeah.
And I think Charlie Francis in track and field in the 80s was probably one of the first...
The pioneer, right?
Yeah, like a coach. He was not a strength coach, but he was a track coach to kind of understand the importance of the central nervous system.
Hmm.
So I think that's a big missing link.
Yeah, it's great. So the... I don't know about discovery, but I mean, you know, putting more importance on nervous system efficiency in athletes and in training, and prescribing rest and recovery protocols to support high levels of nervous system efficiency. Is that kind of what you meant?
Yeah, so you mean like in a microcycle? So let's say you have like recovery days and stuff like that?
Yes, indeed. I mean, well, specifically for fighters, I mean, yeah, you know, out of all of the fighters that I've worked with, there's you know, a trend among all of these guys that, you know, they're chronic under-resters. You know, they just aren't resting enough, cramming in too many training sessions. And so it kind of limits the amount of like high quality nervous system training you can do,
yeah,
because there's that recovery deficit.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So because of that, because you might only be training two or three times a week, then it's even more so important that your training session is of the highest quality.
Yeah, exactly.
Because these are the only shot you have at getting it.
Mm.
But because MMA fighters are their volume of training is so high, then taking recovery methods, using recovery methods that will improve CNS output, becomes very, very beneficial. I mean, the simplest one is to improve sleep.
Yeah, of course.
And then you have nutrients. Like I really like inositol. taking inositol at night. What's good about that is it helps replenish neurotransmitters.
Okay.
So then your training on the next day can potentially have much higher quality because you have a refreshed pool of neurotransmitters for your training.
Okay.
So stuff, you know, simple stuff like that can make a big difference.
Okay. What about some other techniques for active recovery and restorative measures? I mean, you know, ice baths, cryo chambers, stuff like that. You know, you see a lot of MMA fighters doing that kind of thing. What's your take on that sort of recovery?
Yeah, I mean, it's cryotherapy I'm on the fence with because some studies shows it's beneficial. Some studies shows that it can't have an acute response in cortisol output, which is actually counter to recovery.
Right. It creates a spike in cortisol?
Yeah, because of the cold.
Right, okay.
Like your body's response to that stimulus is creating more
stress.
Cortisol, which is a stress hormone.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I'm a little iffy on this one. So then you have, you have methods like a sauna. But again, I'm on the fence. Because I've played a lot with those, and some you have great results with, other athletes you don't. So I just haven't really found even the same thing with IV. So
right.
Because IV is very beneficial with overworked athletes whose nutrition is not optimal.
Right.
But if you're pushing optimal nutrition to your athlete and he's taking multivitamins and minerals on a consistent basis, and then you go and overload him on an acute dose of vitamins and minerals, well, the effect of it won't be this drastic because they're not,
it's not deficit,
crazy deficient in those minerals, so the effect are not great. But then if he eats McDonald's one meal a day all the time and he's fatigued, and then you put him on that, that's going to have a marked effect.
Yep.
So there are so many, but I don't find that they're a big difference maker for the most part. Even massage is the same thing.
Yep.
So I kind of like to, I leave it to the athlete. I made it clear to them that they have to sleep well because that's one proven recovery method, proper sleep. So I always make sure that's emphasized. I tell them to do activities that relaxes them as much as possible. Some it's reading, some was playing like video games, whatever it might be. I don't care as long as they relax. And because that's the thing, like they work so much, they train so much that I don't want to add more burden. Like, so even like yin type activities like yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for some athletes that already have like 15 to 20 training units per week, if I tell them to add yoga because it's a yin activity and it's going to help them relax them, well, some athletes, that stressed them out.
Right.
They didn't want to. They were pissed off. They felt like I was adding a burden to them.
Yep.
So them, it didn't help their recovery because it increased their stress. So it's really individual.
Makes perfect sense. What about flotation tanks? You know, sensory deprivation tanks. Had any experience with those?
I'm not familiar with those.
Okay, no worries. Yeah, that's something we've had a small amount of success with, but it's highly dependent on the individual, whether the individual can actually shut off and fully relax in that moment, you know. So again, you know, it seems like from what you're saying, it's about finding the right recovery methods for the individual.
Yeah, because there are so many of them. And now, like, we have a client here that started playing with those frequency, you know, it's that little kind of helmet you wear that sends frequencies to the brain.
No, I've never seen that.
That kind of helps, like, relax the brain and improve a hormonal profile. It's pretty new, so just playing around with that. But again, it's hard. It's hard to measure these things sometimes.
Yeah. Okay. So, what's this thing called? This helmet?
I forgot the name of it.
Right.
It's fairly new, to be honest.
Okay. I'll do some looking around into
like
that.
A lot of NFL guys have been experimenting with this during the off season.
Yep. Yeah, okay. And what other things can our listeners be looking out for to help improve their neuromuscular efficiency in their training?
I would say that it's important to cycle in phases where you're gonna use training methods in which speed is gonna be even more emphasized, like beyond just accelerating the concentric, but even phases where the eccentric portion will be faster, or phases where you have to create a reactive strength, which means a super fast eccentric that you have to decelerate last minute and then have super fast concentric contraction. So it's based on stretch shortening cycle. So like methods like that, like, because it's just like progress in strength training is just that, finding methods that keeps you progressing over time, that the difficulty level is always a little bit harder. Yep. So I think the first thing is accelerating the concentric, then it's implements that pushes you to accelerate the concentric more, like chains or bands, but then you have to learn to absorb high forces and transfer it to a fast concentric quickly. So it's all about methods like that, but it has to be cycled properly through the training.
Okay, that's excellent. Okay, and with all that said, and everything I know about, you know, your skill set and your background in the industry, how would you describe your specialty in the strength and conditioning field?
So on a general standpoint, my specialty is team sports training, but more specifically, somehow people kind of pigeonhole me as a expert in program design, which I feel like I'm pretty good at it, but I feel that my biggest skill set is at coaching.
Right.
So like cueing, getting an athlete in front of me and seeing what's the weakness in the lift, what to correct to improve the lift as fast as possible. So, you know, sometimes I have people who come to me, they can't do a squat, they have no dynamic flexibility, they're leaning forward too much, they don't have any dorsiflexion, and me, it's like cueing them to get them to squat quickly. So sometimes it might take 3, 4, 5 sessions instead of, you know, just being a training program writer but not understanding the actual application of coaching. So that, I think, is probably my biggest strength as far as the strength and conditioning industry goes.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, your reputation and the outside perception of your specialty is as a programming expert, whereas, you know, in reality, you see your specialty as like in the trenches, you know, hands-on coach. You know, and I think, you know, bridging that gap, you know, is a sign of a real high-level coach. You know, rather than being someone who's in the white lab coat writing, you know, very, very intellectual programs but never spending any time in the trenches. And then you've got the guys in the trenches all day who don't really understand or care about the science and the programming behind everything. It's kind of you are that meeting between those two worlds. And
yeah, I mean, it's it was interesting for me because, you know, in today's social media world, people really know me from, you know, being a Pelican Group instructor, and then the book I wrote, and so that's the perception of people, and it was so program design heavy. That's what they see of me, but they forget the fact that I spent over 30,000 hours in the gym training clients and looking at their training and analyzing their training. So the sometimes experience, like, it's hard to beat.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you brought up the book, 66 Strategies to Program Design. I think I actually forgot to introduce you as an author.
Yeah.
So everybody, Stefan is also an author of a very, very highly regarded book in the strength and conditioning industry called 66 Strategies to Program Design. Could you please just share with us a little bit about that book?
Yeah, so this book, I really wanted to target eye-level coaches. It was not a book that was meant for general pop. It was kind of trying to show the behind the scenes of program design, but with aspects that are never talked about. Because, you know, it seems like it's always the same things. You know, it's about training system that, and then this training system, put this one together. But training is much more complicated than that. So I really wanted to go, like, deep of what's behind it. And then the story about it is 66 strategies to program design. It's based on the study that demonstrated that it takes 66 days to create a new habit instead of the old 3 week that people thought it was. So my thing, I was like, I'm gonna write a strategy every day for 66 days to create the habit of writing. And then the book will be 66 strategies, and you as a reader, you read one strategy a day to get into the habit of learning about training and program design. So that's kind of like the story. So I wrote the book in 66 days, and it was live on Amazon on the 67th day. So I really wanted to be a stickler to the idea behind it. So I'm pretty happy with the process. It was a fun, it was hard, but it was a fun process.
That is fascinating. I've never heard of a process, like a writing process like that. And I love how you've tried to engage the reader into, you know, a 66-day strategy to learning, just as you've built that strategy of writing every day. Have you continued writing?
I mean, I have, but not to the same extent, because the last year was so focused on building a kilo, like, so moving from Rhode Island here, finding a facility, getting the equipment in, all the behind the scenes, and now the focus is on building that group training.
Yeah.
But I mean, to get back to that book, I mean, to me, success in any endeavor it's about habit.
Yeah.
Right, so you have to create habits. Like the same thing with training and nutrition.
Consistency.
You have to be consistent with your training and with your nutrition, and that's how you get results.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. How, just back to the book, how have you found it received so far?
I mean, I've only had great comments about it. I mean, I doubt that I'm sure there's some people who didn't like it, but they obviously didn't reach out to me to tell me. So the only feedback I got was very positive. Like on Amazon, it was all positive reviews. And what was kind of fun is, like, for a while, it was in the sports category, it was a bestseller in Australia, in the UK, and in Canada. So that was kind of... that was kind of cool. And it's fun too, because you get the report from Amazon, you know, every month, and you see where the sales come from, and it's fun to see that it's from all over.
That's
India,
amazing.
Malaysia, everywhere. So it's nice to know that you can impact the training of so many coaches.
That's fantastic. That's amazing. Where, just out of interest, where in the world has given you the most sales?
The United States.
The U.S.
But I think that's just a volume thing,
yeah,
right? There's 330 million people.
Yeah.
But on a per capita, I would say it's probably Canada and Australia.
Yeah. That's great. All right. So why don't we move along a little bit? For the listeners, this facility we're at right now, Kilo Strength Society, as I've probably mentioned 3 or 4 times, it is such a breathtaking facility to be in. It's almost like you've taken the floor plan and the best parts of the Poliquin Group facility, the training facility, and just one-upped everything. You've just enhanced that similar kind of environment, that similar kind of layout, and just put your own touch on it. Could you tell us a little bit more about the founding of Kilo and the facility itself?
Yeah, so Kilo, so how it started is December 2015, I was on vacation in the Dominican Republic, and I was thinking of, you know, like, I'm 38 at that time, I was 38, and I'm like, it's time I do my own thing, and I've always wanted to have my own facility. So I'm like, it's time, I'm ready, I need to do it, just for my you know, my career. So I woke up the next morning with the name Kilo in mind. So I'm like, wow, Kilo, I think it fits, because I didn't want to, you know, so many people, like, they call their business by their names, you know? But to me, I didn't want that, because I wanted to create something that would go beyond just me in a personal standpoint.
Right.
So Kilo to me was simple, easy. Anybody from anywhere in the world can read that word, can understand it, and it represented training. Yep. Kilo, you know, a measure of weight. So, and then I've been doing one-on-one for so long in my career, and I really wanted to shift that to group training. And I wanted to basically use the experience I've had training athletes and create a group training program that would resemble that, but that would be accessible for general pop, but that would somehow, even though it's group training, have a periodization component to it.
Right.
It's impossible to do perfect periodization in a group setup, because you always have people joining at many different times in the year.
Of course.
But I feel I was able to create the best of both world in terms of periodization and the concept of group training. So Alexandra and I, we created 2 years worth of training. It's 384 training programs total, and they're all planned and periodized, and all they all work out in our facility with the space that we have and the 6 power racks that we have. And that's the interesting thing, is a lot of people, they go to a gym, or they open up a gym, they have their equipment, and then they create their group training programs. But us, we created the programs before we got the equipment.
Right.
So we, each and every piece that you see here, it's because it's used at one point or the other in the 2 years worth of training.
Purpose-built facility.
Yeah. So everything, like the layout, the reason why there's 6 power racks, the reason why there's the space in between the series of posterior chain machines and the power racks, all of that is with the group training in mind.
Right.
So it's... We've always been very goal and focus driven by making this facility. So even like the colors, the reason why the Kilo logo is that kind of black and that turquoise, and it's because these colors represented what we wanted to accomplish.
Okay.
Which was more like a gender neutral, kind of like a rich, high quality to it that would attract higher end people of both sexes, but that still perceive this as serious. So colors is very important. That's why like big companies spend so much on
branding.
Research and branding for the right colors to attract people. So that's kind of what we did. And when people come in and they see the colors, even of the upholstery, and it's very South California on top of it, so people get it's very attractive for them. So, you know, I think if you want to make a good business product, you have to think about as many tangibles as you can.
Of course. And tell us, what are some of the challenges that you guys faced putting all of this together? I mean, not just the facility itself, because you told me a little bit about that in person, but I mean, in terms of programming for groups and things like that. I mean, the whole setup.
Yeah, I mean, so the biggest issue was to find a way. So our group training is called Primate, and it's based off of the 8 primary exercises that I've always used in my training of athletes to gauge progress.
And what are they?
So they're the squat, front squat, deadlift, overhead press, incline press, bench press, dip, and chin up.
Wow.
Okay. So these 8 are the core of my training. But the thing is, so the way we split training is the A series is the primary exercise, the B series are the assistance exercise, and the C series are the remedial. But the problem is, usually if I'm training an athlete and I decide to incorporate chains in the training of my athlete on squats, for instance, because it's part of the periodization at one point, I will usually put the chains in the A series on the primary exercise, because that's when the CNS, the nervous system, is fresher, and you'll be able to accelerate the load more. But now the problem is it's a group training setup. So we started January 9th. That's when we opened our facility and started the group training. So we had a client who was there January 9th. He's starting the program. He's training with us. He's getting better. He's improving. He's getting stronger. His technique is better. But now, so today we're in May. If I have a client who joins in May, well, that client is not at the same level as the other guy.
Of course.
So if the other guy, he's ready for chains, and the May program has chains on squat, then what happens to that new person? Chains is way too advanced. He's not there yet. That was the problem. I'm like, okay, now how can we implement these things? Because I wanted our training to represent true training, and I wanted people to have a taste of cool special techniques, to have a taste of chains, eccentric training. Obviously, we're not doing super maximal eccentric because that would be too crazy, but isometric training, weight release. So all these things, I wanted them to try it. But then I noticed it cannot be in the A series. So now what we did is we found a way to integrate these in the B series on the assistance exercise. So this way, even if they get in May and we have chains on the B series, at least the exposure is on the B series. So the duration of the exposure, it's less sets. The intensity is a little bit less. So they get a taste of the special technique, but without the grueling, like wiping out potential of doing 25 minutes of heavy back squat with a chain.
Yeah, right.
So that was a big challenge to kind of make that happen, but still being somewhat logical and effective.
Yep, and kind of making the training sexy, you know, by adding in those you know, more advanced implements without detracting from strength gains in your A series.
Exactly. So basically, the way we use our A series is those primate exercises, they don't really change, but it allows the client to rehearse the movement pattern unchanged. Yeah. So they get better, more efficient at it. And then we use the assistance work to help further the progress of the primary exercises.
Right. That's excellent. Okay. And what about in setting up the facility itself? What challenges did you guys come up against?
there was a lot. But so, for instance, like we decided that we did not want to be in the industrial park or a business park because of the visibility. And because we're not from Huntington Beach, we're not from California, we don't know anybody in California. It's not like a lot of coach trainers, sometimes they train in a gym, then they go in the industrial park, but they bring with them like 20 of their clients. We didn't have that opportunity, so we needed visibility. So we needed to be in a commercial zoning area. But the problem is a lot of strip mall in the United States, it's either they don't allow gyms, and even though we told them that we're a private facility, their perception of a gym is 100 cars at 5 p.m. that clogs the parking lot. So it's either they don't accept that, or if they do accept gym, they don't accept startups.
Right.
So it was very hard to find a good location with good visibility with the size that we wanted. So that took a while. It was very challenging. Sometimes we found a place, but the ceiling was only 8 feet high. Mm-hmm. It's too short, so it didn't work. So all these things. And then once we got the facility, then everything has to be approved by the city. So there's all these rules and regulations that you have to adhere to. And we all, because our goal is to build a long-lasting product with Kilo, we wanted to be by the books with everything.
Yeah, of course.
That was very important for us.
Of course. What about getting closer to your opening date for Kilo, for the actual facility? As I understand, you guys had a few hiccups with equipment and deliveries and things like that.
Yeah, so I put a lot of emphasis on having a nice floor for the gym, and we had our first primate training camp with students was December 5th. So we needed the gym to be ready by that time for the camp, because we had 12 or 13 people coming in that day for those 5 days. So the floor install crew comes in, and they wrecked the floor, and it was unbelievable. There were seams everywhere, and it was horrible. But we had no choice, so they still put the machines on the floor, and we did the course. But then after the course, I told the install crew company's owner that it was unacceptable, so he came, and when he saw the job himself, he couldn't believe it. So we decided to replace the floor, but our opening was January 9th, and then it was the Christmas holidays. And then the manufacturing company who makes the floor, they only make that floor on demand, so they had to manufacture that floor again. So basically, he sent a different crew on January 5th, and in 4 days, they were able to take the equipment out, take the floor out, fix the cement floor underneath the floor that the first crew didn't do, put the new floor in, put the equipment back in 4 days, right in time for the opening.
Wow.
And now the job is flawless. There's zero seams. Everything looks great.
It does. Super sharp. It looks really stunning. And so these guys, to fix the job, did in 4 days what the previous crew took 2 weeks to fuck up.
Yeah, exactly. It was unbelievable.
Oh, that's fantastic. So we're here in Huntington Beach, which, as most of our listeners would probably know, this is historically Huntington's a bit of a hotbed for mixed martial arts. All the way back to the days of Tank Abbott in, the first few UFC events that were held. Tank was, one of the fan favorites. And through to Tito Ortiz, who's also one of the most popular, UFC fighters of all time. These guys were staples, in mixed martial arts early on, and they were, they were Huntington Beach natives. The scene here in Huntington Beach for MMA has been quite strong from the early days of the sport. What's your impression of the MMA scene here today?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It definitely seems like it's alive, well and alive. There's so many mixed martial arts gym all over town. There's King's MMA. There's a ton of Gracie Barra spots. There's also even a ton of more traditional martial arts like Wing Chun and all these kind of things. But it seems to be doing well. It seems alive. And we're lucky here at Kilo because in the same strip mall as the Kilo gym, there's a Gracie Barra facility.
Yeah.
So because I do have experience in the past training mixed martial artists, that could definitely be a good hotbed for us to get Kilo a little bit more involved in the Huntington Beach community with mixed martial arts.
Absolutely. So you haven't tried to make any inroads over there to Gracie Barra?
Yeah, I mean, we met the owner, super nice lady. So we're in the we're in the talks to try to do some type of a partnership.
Yep.
But we just want something fair for both parties. So that's in the works.
That's fantastic. That's one very lucky jiu-jitsu club. So on the topic of fighters and MMA and all that kind of stuff, from your experience, what are some of the key principles for strength and conditioning training that fighters should be looking at?
Yeah, so I really think that posterior chain strength, and by posterior chain I mean everything from the calves, the Achilles tendons, the calf, the hamstring, the glutes, the lower back, the upper back, to the neck, are probably the most important yet most undertrained muscles in the MMA arsenal. Because most of the power comes from your posterior chain. Most of the stability comes from the posterior chain. Mm-hmm. And if you look at because of my background with NFL players, a lot of the studies and concussions, which is something that's happening in mixed martial arts as well, can be prevented with stronger neck muscles.
Mm-hmm.
When you're short with time, I feel that neck extensors is what you get the most bang for your buck with. If you have more time, you can definitely focus on lateral muscle. And there's even this new I forget the name of it, but it's this new Ed harness.
The Iron Neck?
The Iron Neck.
Yeah.
That allows you to do rotational work. Yep. I think that's a pretty clever tool. I mean, it's a little pricey, but if you train a lot of fighters, I think it's something that might be worth considering, because it's very clever to be able to work rotational neck strength with a pulley system.
Yep.
For that constant tension, that's easier to control than like the good old towel.
Yeah.
So neck muscles, but not only that. Like if you're training the neck, you have to train all contraction modalities. You cannot just always do like isotonic controlled reps all the time. You also need to have strong eccentric strength to withstand blows. You need to have some sort of ballistic strength component, isometric strength on certain position and fighting. So you need to take into account all of these contraction modes into your neck training. But then if we go further down posterior chain, then we go to chin up, we go to deadlift. That's why deadlift is also an exercise I like to use as a predictor lift, mm-hmm. because it's a good posterior chain builder. That I think for me is the biggest missing link.
Yeah, posterior chain right from the Achilles all the way up to the neck extensors.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fantastic. And you're right, it's so neglected. So few strength coaches are talking about the entire posterior chain for fighters. So I think that's something that the audience could get a lot out of. We're going to have to start thinking about wrapping this up, mate. I've only got a couple of questions left for you. Firstly, what are some of the most valuable lessons you've learned through your own experimentation and developing your own ideas?
Take care of your data. Don't be lazy as a coach when you're training a client. Don't be careless about writing all the sets and reps and issues or injuries or tweaks that your client might have with the training program you give them, because it's only by being thorough in analyzing your work and your client's numbers that you can actually become a better coach. And that maybe is the whole programming component I was telling you about, because that allows you to tweak and improve whichever training system you're working with. But if you're careless, if you don't write down your training programs, or if you write it down in a sheet of paper, you give it to your client fills out the sheet of paper and his month program is done, then he keeps the sheet and then you give him a new sheet, but you don't tally back that information,
yep.
Well, then you're not building a product. You don't have tangible numbers to build a decent product, because you don't know the outcome.
Yep.
So I think that's a big mistake a lot of younger coaches do. I was foreseeing it from early on, because I've always been meticulous about it. And also when I worked in that commercial gym in Montreal, we were 35 trainers and we all had to fight to get clients. And because I was serious about being a strength coach, I wanted serious clients. So what I did is I always had a notepad. I always had a stopwatch around my neck and always had my pen. I would always count the reps out loud, and I would even count the tempos, just because I understood that when you're coaching a client, it's not just about the client you're training, it's about the other clients in the gym looking at you, shopping for their own coaches.
Right.
So if they saw I was extremely professional and very attentive to detail and looking at every aspect of my clients, I knew that they were looking at me and analyzing it. So if they were serious, they would perceive me as a more serious coach. So then they would hire me. Mm-hmm. So it didn't take that long. It took maybe 18 months before I had a good base, but a very serious clients. And my retention was great because my results were better because they were more serious to start with. Mm-hmm. But on the positive side, on top of it, it allowed me to have better data, more accurate data, because they were more serious trainees.
Yeah, got it. So protecting your data, looking after your data at all costs. What are some of the best ways you've seen to do that in terms of software or different organizing systems?
Yeah, I mean, as far as software, like I'm using Vitruvian.com by Pelican Group. I like it because everything is automated. So it allows you to see your clients' weights and sets, tonnage, poundage, predicted 1RM, total reps, average weight. So all this data that I like to use in my own training, it allows me to see it automatically. So as soon as they're done with their training program and they enter their weights and they click save, I have access to this. Mm-hmm. So I can better tailor the progression of my client's training. So that for me is a very useful tool. I know others, they use Google spreadsheets, whatever it might be, whatever system fits you best. But for me, Vitruvian is just the quickest, most efficient way of doing it.
Yeah, it gives you all the feedback you need in order to write progressions. Yeah. Based on, you know, if there's a weak spot or a weak lift from the current program, you're fully aware and you can adapt the upcoming program to address that.
Yeah, and then I'm a little bit old school with that, but then I have a binder, old school binder with all of my clients' files, and then I tally up the information and build my periodization template in that binder.
Right.
So it's a combination of that binder and the Vitruvian software.
That's awesome.
That allows me to do my work.
I love it. I do the same thing, except I use Google spreadsheets.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. There was one more question for you. Are there any books or resources that you could recommend for our listeners for anything we've spoken about today or anything in general that's specific to fight trainers?
Yeah, I find it very difficult because I find that most books by trainers or strength coaches are too system-based. So it's very hard for a reader or an upcoming strength coach to get a good grasp of what's going on and how to actually really apply it on your own. So that's why I'm a big fan of younger coaches reading the old school textbooks. Mm-hmm. Where it's more scientific data, because if you can understand the concepts of protein degradation, motor unit activation, recovery curves, all these things, then you can better understand all the other systems and or create your own system because you understand everything that's behind strength and conditioning.
Yes.
So for that matter, I mean, we touched on him earlier, like Vladimir Zatsiorsky's Science and Practice of Strength Training. That's my favorite book. Now, obviously, there are things in it that are maybe antiquated, but for the most part, it's a very good, very in-depth training methodology book. Super Training by Meltsev. It's a classic.
Verkhoshansky and Meltsev.
Verkhoshansky and Meltsev. That's a classic.
Yeah.
You know, there's a ton of good books like that. Physiology of Training by Gregory White is another great one that I really like. That's more recent. That's like 2006, I think. Mm-hmm. This is what I suggest. So it's not as much a training philosophy per se, as it is more about knowing true training methodologies.
Yeah.
And then you can make your own mind in terms of philosophies, because there's so much out there. So
yeah, I mean, understanding the organizing principles behind program design and training itself, so that you can create your own kind of mark and your own way of doing things. I suppose there's so much more value in that than just getting a system to plug into and not have to think about anything.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I always, obviously, with the Pelican Group background, I often have coaches approaching me and say, "Ah, Steph, like, what do you think about the 6-12-25 and the 5x5 and then the you know, like GBC, blah, blah. Great, but that's just a training phase. That's not really training. Mm. So I want people to learn what's behind training. So if they want to use these systems, when should they use them, how to pair them up. But that's the thing. There's no real book on that. It's up to you to understand training so you can figure that out.
Yeah.
Because I get that all the time, because people see that I love periodization. So they, Steph, what book did you read to know that? Which book do you suggest? None. I've never seen a good book on periodization. So there's like Tudor Bumpa's Principles of Periodization.
Right.
But it's so, like, it's so, like, Olympic coach. Mm. It doesn't give you a good grasp of strength training periodization.
He doesn't tell you how to do it.
No, it's like you read that. Okay, yes, that's a macrocycle. That's a mesocycle. Mm. This is a transition phase, blah, blah, blah. So you get the big picture of it, but you still don't. Okay, but now do I do 8 reps here, mm. 4 here, or is it 8 reps here, 7 here? Mm-hmm. Or like, it does, you don't know any of that,
yeah,
from these books. So to me, it's, I will never say that reading is a waste of time, but it's not there, it's not reading that book that's going to make you, yeah, now I'm great at programming, yeah, and periodization.
Yeah.
You don't get that from these books.
It's one of the beautiful things that I found about this life as a strength coach, is that no one answers all those questions and answers all those problems for you. It's not handed to you. You've got to actually go out and dig and research. And you know, you need to be passionate about these things in order to put your own systems together, in order to be great at this. And I think if anybody's looking for a book to answer all those questions and simplify everything and have it all handed to them, they're missing the point. They're missing all the beauty of it.
No, you're 100% right. And also, it's also understanding where that author is coming from.
Yeah.
So Bumpa was like a rowing coach. Mm-hmm. He was a rowing sports coach. He was never a strength coach, so most of the data is relevant to him. Mm. But then you transpose it to you training your hockey players, or the same thing with like Olympic lifting coaches. Mm. And when they talk about lift percentages, well, that's cool, but if you're doing a clean, a snatch, there's no tempo. Mm. It's a very simplistic, variable free movement to analyze, so it's easy to create data and normative data because it's always the same thing.
Control.
But then if you're trying to take this information and transpose it to a 5-0-1-0 bench press, where's the correlation?
Yeah.
So it's for, like you said, it's for you to understand and then you make sense of it.
Yeah. And where you take it is entirely up to you.
And in the context of your own practice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. So before we tie this up, first of all, how can people get in touch with you? And what's this year hold for you? The rest of 2017. What does that look like?
Yeah. So people can reach us on our Facebook and Instagram page, which is Kilo Strength Society, or they can even go to our website, kilostrengthsociety.com. As far as what's coming up this year, so well, this next Friday, so not this Friday, but Friday, June 9th, we have the sports specific training camp starting. So it's 5 days, it's a training camp, it's 2-a-day training with sports specific methodologies, with theory during the day. We have a hypertrophy training camp coming up in July. We have a power camp coming up in August, strength camp in October, and the primate training camp in November. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what's coming for me. I don't intend to travel yet this year because I'm just too busy with the facility here, but that's something, once here is more settled, that I'm willing to, interested in looking into, to offer some of this content to people from around the world as mm-hmm. well.
Well, you'll have to keep us in the loop for any Australian stuff you might want to do.
Yeah, Australia will definitely be destination.
Absolutely, yeah. As you were saying, most of your interest has been from Canada and Australia, outside of the States, that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, well, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, it was a pleasure.
I've had a great time, and yeah, thanks everyone for listening.